May it please the court, Jim Owen for CFES. CFES attacks only one aspect of the funding formula, the definition of local effort in Senate Bill 287 that freezes the assessed valuations from 2004 into the calculation of all future years, despite the fact that those valuations were not equalized, assessed valuations, as required by the Constitution in two separate statutes. And they are not uniform, and they are not equalized. I submit only three questions.
Is the constitutional requirement uniformity?
Both uniformity. Article 10, Section 3 is uniformity in taxation. Equalized assessed valuations is required by Article 10, Section 14, Sections 138-400 and Section 138-395.
But the specifics that you claim are being violated are the specifics as to that are in the statute about
and the Constitution. Equalized. What happened, Your Honor, was when they set about Senate Bill 287, they froze in what is called the local effort deduction from what all the school districts get in their state funding. As you guys know, local effort in the local funding, the assessors are supposed to go out and use their best local effort to get assessments at plus or minus 5% from 95% of true value. School districts rely on 70% of their funding for that local effort from local money. But in the state funding, if they're out there doing their best to get at that 95% plus or minus 5%, then, of course, in the state funding, you're supposed to get a deduction from your state funding because they're out there doing their best job.
Isn't the amount that the state pays frozen until 2013, though?
I'm sorry?
Is the amount the state pays frozen until 2013, so it's the same within all districts?
It's frozen for all future years on that 2004 level, which we showed uncontroverted evidence was frozen in 2004. The respondent said, well, that's okay. The two documents that we were so happy to see in their brief said that the legislature relied on were two documents that were absolutely, under uncontroverted evidence, wrong.
So the state makes up, between now and 2013, the state makes up the difference between the local effort and the 6,100?
No, what you're thinking of, it went in a seven-year flow, the funding went in. But those numbers that you're thinking of, Your Honor, you're mixing the two differences. The local effort number is frozen in a seven-year funding, but that 2004 level,
where's the prejudice as to what the state is doing?
What they're saying is that number, that we can't redistribute that money, that number, we're not going to be harmed because that number doesn't get redistributed. Everybody's funding for that year is equally separate. In other words, figure this school district's number, you figure this school district's number, you figure this school district's number. So the trial court said, well, if they're all being, funding is being just figured out for each separate school district, we can't prove that the state would have redistributed the number, or given us more money and redistributed the money.
And if I understand your argument correctly, you're saying had they done it correctly, the state would have actually paid less money.
Actually, what we're saying, Your Honor, is two things. We said if they had done it, they have to do it correctly. You can't take the wrong amounts of assessed. Number one, you have to use equalized assessed valuations. Mm-hmm. The Constitution requires that. What they did was they took two figures. They took non-equalized assessed valuations and put it in the formula for 2004. The statute said use equivalent sales ratios. Statute says that, and what they did was...
Aren't you getting into the issue you say you've abandoned on appeal, which is has to do with whether the state...
No, what we abandoned, Your Honor, was we started the lawsuit before 2000, before this new statute came, before the funding was changed. Then we said we're abandoning that because now they put in 2004 figures. We changed and we said what you did was in 2004 you froze in equivalent sales ratios. We looked at it. They used the only state of 50 states to use equivalent appraisal ratios. The statute says equivalent sales ratios. Why is that important? Equivalent sales ratios would look at sales and would say you have to use equalized assessed
valuation. If you could address the issue raised in opposing counsel's brief in response to your argument that what you're doing really is attacking what the state tax commission has done.
Your Honor, all we did was use a state tax commission could not be a necessary party because we aren't attacking the state tax commission.
Aren't you saying the remedy has to be that they have to use a different value and get a different value from the state tax commission?
No, Your Honor. What we said was, let's put it this way. If you have the average daily attendance figure for 2004. And the legislature instead said the average daily attendance figure, which was the other component of the formula. And they used the wrong average daily attendance figure. And they froze that in the formula. We wouldn't attack the numbers that were submitted by the school districts on the average daily attendance figure. We wouldn't have to sue the people who brought in the average daily attendance figures, Jesse. We wouldn't have to sue them, and they wouldn't be a necessary party. The people submitting the figures are not a necessary party. We don't have to sue them. They can't change that. That was in 2007. They were submitting 2004 figures. Suing the tax commission is saying you gave us the wrong figures.
But is it part of your argument that the assessed evaluation between the counties differs, and that's a responsibility of the state tax commission?
What the state tax commission could or could not do when the statute was passed in 2007 to change the figures that were from 2004 is impossible. We couldn't sue the tax commission or anybody and say, change the figures for 2004.
So what are you saying should be done? What are you saying the remedy
would
be?
What we said should be done is we say, since a statute that was passed in 2007, bringing in 2004 figures that are frozen forevermore, we say you cannot rely on 2004 figures that are wrong, that are in violation of the Constitution.
How do you know they're wrong? When the State Tax Commission relied on them, no one appealed those assessments, and they're not a party here to defend their finding that those were appropriate.
Your Honor, if again, that would be the same as if you were to say,
Well, just address what I am saying.
Okay, if the State Tax Commission was in court, and everybody put on the evidence the same again, all I ask you to do is, for some reason, people have a hard time with assessment. They think, if I had average daily attendance figures that were wrong, I couldn't bring in the people to say those numbers are wrong.
But
we
brought
in the numbers.
I understand what you're addressing. It's assessments. Tell me what you're saying the remedy would be other than getting them to reassess in some way.
No, you wouldn't have to reassess, Your Honor. You would have to basically say you have to strike down that one part of the statute mm-hmm. that says you can rely on 2004 figures that are wrong, unquestionably wrong, and are fixed in the formula forever because if you have figures in the statute that say 95% and 70%.
And what are you saying they should rely on then?
You have, Your Honor, I'm not asking you to fix it. I'm saying you strike down that one part of the formula and send it back to the legislature to fix it, or else what you have
right. But how's the legislature, how's the statute bad? You're saying they did not follow the statute correctly.
Because the statute and the Constitution require. If you have in Cole County, where this assessor does a marvelous job, and St. Mm-hmm. Charles County does a marvelous job, but in the neighboring county, they are doing it at 75%, 80%.
So you're saying they're not carrying out the statute correctly?
Or the Constitution. Why they have that?
So your remedy is what?
If a statute is in violation of the Constitution and subordinate statute.
How is the statute in violation of the Constitution?
Why the Constitution and the statutes were set up to have a system to cause equalized assessed valuations so that all the assessed valuations, they can't just submit figures to the legislature.
I understand, but can you tell me where in the statute, you're saying the statute does it wrong, as opposed to you're saying they're carrying out the statute incorrectly?
The statute required equivalent sales ratios
okay.
to go to the legislature and equalize assessed valuations. All three, the Constitution and the statutes required.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Now, you see that the state or the legislature incorrectly relied upon the 2004 figures. What information did they have to know that those figures were wrong when, you know, assessment's not an exact science?
Judge Rose, what they had was they had a state auditor's report that came in and said you were the only state in the union using equivalent appraisal ratios. They had legislative messages from the state tax commission that said all assessments in the state are if you continue to use these figures, then you have lack of uniformity and lack of equalization. 8 years in a row, they said that. They had the Senator Caskey and the Joint Interim Committee. This is all before they passed this legislation. The Joint Interim Committee saying, you're using appraisal ratios and you shouldn't. They had them saying to them, you have lack of equalization across the state. And yet, they had the State Tax Commission sending out letters to the counties across the state in what's called the compliance rate section, with their sales ratio saying you are completely out of whack. St. Louis County, 36% off. I'm sorry, city. St. Louis County, 25% off. Other counties, you're completely off. You have to change. And as we all know, around the state of Missouri, since 2004, assessments have changed dramatically and gone up.
But they didn't have the report prepared by Steve Gardner at UMSL, did they?
That, Your Honor, was what we put on to show that 71% of the state was off. We threw that on top of it. We put that on to show that in addition to the nine counties that the State Tax Commission was telling the legislature and what the auditor was telling the tax commission, what the Joint Interim Committee was telling the legislature, I was saying the tax commission, on top of that, we put in an additional study, which the trial court found credible. On top of all of that, we put in additional evidence. But what Your Honor, what Judge Roach, what you were asking was, we put that in addition to that, to tell them that, you know, to show that after the study, or after 2007, this is how bad it was. And if you continue with this, it is exactly like having the wrong attendance figures frozen in 2004, and how in the heck we can say that that is okay to have the wrong numbers and believe that we are not damaged, and to believe that we don't have standing to say that something is wrong in the statute and we're going to continue to go along with it is beyond me. But well, thank you very much.
Let me ask you this about remedy, to return to Judge Stitt's question about remedy. So if you strike down the provision that says that you're freezing the 2004 rates,
yes,
then the legislature has to enact something in its place.
Yes, it does.
Which would be?
What they would enact, Your Honor, is what we've told them, what we have asked them to do, of course, is try to take out a provision that is going to be kicking out what we say is a deduction that is improper. You have basically all the deductions that are improper.
What so would they that will be do, recalculated every year then?
You could, we've had Senator Gibbons, a lot of people have been talking about what they would do or should do. What we hope they would do would be to say, get the proper assessment figures, which since 2004 are very much, I won't say proper, but have, the State Tax Commission has done a very good job, and so have the counties, at getting it up. And I think, I won't say what's happened since 2004, but I think most of the judges know that around the state, assessments have been equalized significantly since 2004. So if they use the correct figures now, there will be a lot of districts that are no longer like Cole County and Callaway County was a year ago, where Callaway County, and because they share school, the counties share taxing districts, Callaway County or Cole County subsidizing Callaway County.
Thank you, Council.
And if, I'm sorry.
I had one more question, yes, about the about the remedy, and that is if you start with the an honest set of assessment numbers,
yes, sir,
equal or uniform.
Both of those.
Do the districts that you represent, does that increase their ability to raise more money by local effort because of the greater availability of state?
Excellent question, Your Honor. What happens, exactly what you said, what's happened since 2007 and 2004 was our districts have been able to raise more local money because of the assessments have increased. That hasn't been reflected in the deductions. The deductions continue to show this inequality in the school funding formula. So that people.
So does that make the inequality more profound?
It's unbelievable. Right now, the guys who are not doing anything on the local level are continuing to get this deduction from 2004. They don't do anything for a local effort, but they're getting a big deduction. And all we're saying is that is, it's just ridiculous, number one. I don't know a legal word for it. But the, through 2004, the deduction continues. They get a deduction even though they're not doing anything for local level.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you. Sorry it takes so much time.
Always time to answer the judge's questions.
Thank you. I did learn that from you.
May it please the court. First of all, I want to give my condolences to my friend Jim Layton, who didn't go through the trial on this thing. So if you've seen him here in this building working late hours, you will know why, because he's had to read himself into what the other people in the at that end of the table and Mr. McAdams back here went through for some time. If I might, I would ask leave to have the marshal distribute a 2 pages out of the appendix. There's a lot of paper, but I think maybe this may have been missed. But it's a color-coded what happened to the critical constitutional provisions, 1875, 1865, 1875, 1945. I think they show some things that are constant and some that are not constant. This case is clearly important. It impacts potentially the current almost 900,000 school kids in the state of Missouri, and subsequently on into the future years, as there's the turnover every 12, 13, 14 years, depending on whether there's early childhood education or not. So it is important. I will try to answer questions and point out a few things within the brief period of time. Our group, the Committee for Educational Equality, there are over 200 school districts, about 300,000 kids in those districts. We've had focus districts for a dozen that went from Caruthersville and the Boot Heel to Worth County R3 in North Missouri, to Southwest Missouri, to Central Missouri. We have a number of other districts, such as the Hannibal School District, which I believe one of the judges may be familiar with. We've had Stoutland, we've had Tuscumbia. So it impacts, and we've had Albany besides Worth County. We've had Savannah up in your territory, Judge. And not to forget, we have all of Cedar County, practically, down around Nevada. And Judge Price, we even have Raytown and Independence in Kansas City.
I thought you were going to talk about Lee County, Iowa.
No, we don't go that far. The superintendent, by the way, in Worth County, came from Iowa, so that's the closest I can get. The constitutional provisions on the general diffusion of knowledge have not changed very much since 1865. The only thing has been really the ages.
Well, another change, though, from 1865, the equality standard was removed.
But in 1945, equal opportunities was put into the Constitution. And I think, and when you look at the 1875 convention, and it dropped out in the 18, and there wasn't any debate about it, the 1875 convention. That was dropped out. The provision that the legislature could, say, impose a local property tax on school district X was in the 1865 convention. I don't think that was ever done, but that was to authorize the General Assembly to have that authority. The difference, that then was replaced by the 25% of state revenue provision. And you'll see by looking at the handout, the wording of make up the deficiency, that language went back to that provision in the 1865.
What is state revenue?
What
is state revenue?
The closest thing I think you can draw from the cases are general revenue. Monies that are in these general revenue funds. Last time I was here, I was told that some things were not part of the state revenue in 1998. If you look back, I think state revenue is close to general revenue. And if, for instance, revenue...
Why isn't the money that comes from the federal government not state revenue?
Because this court said, and I argued that.
I'm giving you another chance at it.
I think it ought to be the whole pie. It depends on how you cut the pie.
And maybe I asked the wrong guy, sorry.
But you see, we only had the 25% of state revenue actually for a very brief period of time. It was statute in the Kelly Act in 1853 But then after the 1875 was put in the Constitution, from 1887 on, it was a third of state revenue, of the state revenue. Sometimes they used ordinary revenue. If you look back, it was an annual appropriation type of bill directing the auditor to cut up the pie to 25%. Now, that continued. In the 50s, we got up to 37%. But I think one of the things that's come with both briefs, both our brief and the other brief, are references to Texas. Texas had a 25%, would not, the first try at it by the Texas Constitution was in 1876, not more than 25% of state revenue. Then they found out that was not enough. So they reversed it in the 1880s to language such as ours to make, but it was a special type of revenues may appropriate these general type of revenues if necessary, if needed. The same sort of type of thing we have here. And the ongoing Texas litigation, the Carrollton case, which was in the early 90s, said these were basically different pots of money. And so consequently, in the Texas Supreme Court, while that remains, while there's a subsection C of Section 3 of Article 7 in the Texas Constitution that allows additional monies to be appropriated. Now, that is very similar to the Missouri situation, and there, I've mentioned in the brief, and I mentioned here again, I thought maybe I could look over and see his picture, but it's moved out of this room, Judge Elijah Norton.
Yes, right there. First one, we think.
Okay.
With the hair.
But Judge Norton was sort of the Dick Webster of the 1875 Constitution, in that his fingers, if you look around, you could find what happened. He'd served in Congress. He'd been a circuit judge. And Judge Higgins tells me is quite an expert on that. He's told me his history. But it appears that he was the one that engineered, I should use that term in Websterism terminology, putting in the 25% of state revenue the way it is. Because they wanted to, they were jumpy about having authority to raise money, because the 1875 convention was all about cutting off and putting limits on taxes. So they put that provision in place of the spillover from the 1865 about being able to have local taxes assessed by the levied by the Supreme by the General Assembly. But if you look, Judge Norton came on this court 1 year later, and 2 years later he rendered the sharp decision, which I think is precedent, has not been overruled. It involved, if you'll look at the second page of the handout, the same type of provision. And this court in that case indicated that there was a separate obligation under Section 1A, or 1 at that point, it was Section 1, from the provision about the authorization. So I think, and since that time, at least since, I should say, 1887, there's been more money spent than 25% of state revenue, assuming we don't put in the, and I'd like to put in the federal taxes. I'd like to put in the unemployment gimmick that they get away with putting the money in the, from Washington, D.C., comes to central bank and then goes back and forth. I'd like to include that. It'd be nice to include all the revenue of the state universities and colleges. We have a lot of dedicated education funds that should not be considered. For instance, Prop C, the 1 cent sales tax. Is that in or out? Our position, though, and this has been, while we don't think there was 25% of the state revenue is being parceled out to the various districts, we do feel that the focus should be on Article 1, Section 1, and equal opportunities. Now, the equal opportunities language has really never been focused upon. It meshes here. I would say this, though, that the general diffusion of knowledge language and those states that have applied it, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Texas, have had no problems of reading into that general diffusion an equitable distribution. The record in this case shows that expenditures per pupil run from $4,700 in Diamond to over $15,000 per pupil. The assessed valuation runs from about $19,000 per pupil to $400,000 per pupil. Now, when you go down to Caruthersville and it's $22,000 per pupil, they really can't, even with insurance, rebuild the high school that was damaged by the tornado. The facilities problem is one that has never been touched, really, except that this court has repeatedly said that property is a school district property, is held in trust for the state because it's the state's obligation under Article 9, Section 1. So we would suggest respectfully that.
But you're not. Are you arguing that the result of the allocations under the formula have to be equal? Because as I understand the formula, it's an equal access to money, not an equal money. In other words, if you go to a certain level of local effort, you should have the same amount of money yielded by that, whether you're in District A or District B.
That was more like Senate Bill 380, Senate Bill 287, and because you have so many hold harmless provisions, its targets at 6117 under the 287.
But they were still operating from the principle, even in the
right,
in the
right.
most recent one,
right.
of access to money rather than results.
Correct, and I think that basically that's in the equal opportunities. It's the state's obligation to provide those opportunities. I think it's the inputs more than it is the outputs. We can argue about that all day long.
So in part, the child, the amount of money spent on a child is dependent upon the will of the voters of his school district.
And
the board.
And once Senate Bill 380 is phased out, the problems become more on the local taxation. The local, it assumes, for instance, and this is one of the problems, it assumes that every district has a tax levy of $3.43. Well, under Hancock, the state cannot mandate that.
So 275 is what's in the Constitution.
Right. And so consequently, we've got a Hancock problem. And you, with the districts that do not have, that say are in the 20 to 25,000 assessed valuation, they're caught in that dilemma between the 275 and 343, even if they want to. And they sure as the devil cannot fund a new high school. You cannot fund a new high school in East Carter, for example.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
May it please the court. May I too have leave to distribute something to the court?
Please.
Thank you. This is largely overlaps with the language cited by in the exhibit from CE from the appellants, but is in a structure that is close to the way it was described by Judge Callahan. I am not here today to apologize for the Missouri schools for two reasons. The first is because there is no apology necessary. We provide excellent schools, excellent educational opportunities, all the way from Tarkio to Hannibal to Nevada, because of dedicated teachers in the classroom, dedicated school board members and others. But more importantly, I'm not here to apologize for them because, frankly, that's not what's before the court. Key to the court's determination is an analysis of two constitutional provisions, Article 9, Section 1A, and Article 2, Article 1, Section 2. I'll begin with Article 9, Section 1A, and the related sections. This court's job, of course, is to maintain the integrity of the language, recognizing that what the voters in 1945 saw was not the color-coded chart, but simply the language that exists in the Constitution. And they voted on that language given their understanding of the way schools operated in Missouri in 1945, which, like today, is largely a system that is subject to local control and local funding. If you look at the chart I provided, we've divided it out in terms of what questions one might pose and how they would be answered in the Constitution. The first question is, what is it the General Assembly must do? Well, the General Assembly shall establish and maintain free public schools for the instructions of all persons in this state within ages not in excess of 21 years as prescribed by law. Of course, that's the traditional language for something that awaits legislative determination rather than judicial. There is, of course, preceding that, the preparatory introductory language of Section 1A. Why do we do that? The Jeffersonian language of a diffusion of knowledge and intelligence. That's the reason, but it is not itself a substantive requirement. There are, of course, some substantive requirements in the Constitution beyond Section 1A. One of those, not in the exhibit you got from Mr. Bartlett, is in Section 5 that deals with the with certain school funds, which are then to be allocated out to the schools. And the other two come in Section 3B, the 25% requirement that Judge Wolf asked about, which comes at the end of 3B. And before that, the provision that says that the school fund provided set apart by law, shall be insufficient to sustain free school for 8 months each year, the legislature may allocate more.
So where's the equal opportunity provision?
That's in Article 1, Section 2. It doesn't refer directly to the to education. It is simply the equal protection provision that did not exist in the Missouri Constitution until 1945. In addition to the provisions on this particular, in these sections, 1A, 3B, and 5, you have use elsewhere, as noted in our brief, of this word adequate. In Section 9 of Article 9, there is a reference to adequate funding for the state universities. Those who drafted, those who voted for the Constitution knew how to use that word adequate when they meant it, and they did not include it in the provisions that CEE relies on. But I think that they also within the language here, you find some hints that someone would see if they read this language in 1945, demonstrating that this concept that the courts could enforce some level of educational adequacy is really alien to the language that the people adopted. One of those, of course, is this provision is in the what to do provision itself, where it talks about education within ages not in excess of 21 years are prescribed by law. That was a change, as you can see from Mr. Bartlett's chart, that under the prior provision it said ages 6 to 21. This was a time when having kindergarten was a matter of great debate, and those who drafted this wanted to change the Constitution, so the legislature clearly had the authority to pay for kindergarten if it wished, And the legislature in 1963, not 1945, made kindergarten mandatory. But the language that was adopted there did not say that my son who turns 19 and goes off to college is still entitled to state funding. It did not say that someone who is 3 or 4 years old is entitled to state funding. It said the legislature decides who is entitled to state funding between the ages from birth to age 21. Another place that you see here that demonstrates that you can't read this diffusion language as the CE wants you to read it is that provision that speaks about 8 months in every school year. Under the 1875 Constitution, there was a 4-month minimum. The legislature was to act if we couldn't get 4 months funded on the local level. The people in 1945 deliberately changed it to 8. They did not change it to 9 or 10, as the CEE requirement or CEE arguments would require. They left that determination in the hands of the General Assembly. And this court should do the same, to affirm what the people in 1945 said, which is it is the responsibility of the General Assembly to decide how it is we're going to establish and maintain our free public schools. The other provision, of course, is the equal opportunity provision added in the 1945 Constitution. I will confess that until the last few days, I hadn't read that section of the constitutional debates. It's the amount in which that and the Article 1A discussion dwelt on the racial segregation that was involved in Missouri at that time was eye-opening to me, even as someone who spends a fair amount of time with the Missouri Constitution. That says, of course, that all persons are created equal and entitled to equal rights and opportunity under the law. But you have to get from that to some kind of remedy. And so if you look at the brief from CEE, here's how the analysis goes. Education is a fundamental right, so it's subject to strict scrutiny. And then the argument just ends. And I suspect it ends because there's no good explanation for how you would apply what we traditionally call strict scrutiny in this context. So look at what strict scrutiny is, what we usually do in the equal protection context. First, we look for two similarly situated individuals. Now, that's, of course, always individuals. It's not political subdivisions. There is no right of one school district to have the same thing that another school district has. Not the Clayton School District and the Tarkio School District and the Diamond R4 School District have no constitutional right to the same things any more than the cities of Tarkio and Clayton have rights to the same thing. It has to be for students. And that we've always recognized that two people who live in different places, in different cities, in different communities, are, because of that, probably not similarly situated. Well, the argument being made here is you get rid of all of that, and somehow you create that you call every student in the state similarly situated, except that really isn't the argument, because we have in this argument that concept of horizontal equity, and then we have the introduction of something entirely new in Missouri jurisprudence, a concept of vertical equity. That is, we don't give everybody the same opportunity, or maybe we do give them all the same opportunity, but it requires we all give them something different. I don't really know how to articulate that. And so I don't really know how to fit it into this concept of equal protection as this court has described it.
But if you set up a system where some districts have much greater ease at accessing a different result than some other district trying to access the same result, then haven't you set it up so that the children in one district are disadvantaged by the law of the state and not just by the lack of local inspired leadership or whatever it is running school districts?
Well,
on
I think
local
that would
level.
Be true of not just schools but everything else that happens in those communities.
Well, but the point is that the state's law should not rig the game in favor of one set of districts as opposed to another.
The state's law here does two things. The first is it gives every school district in the state the ability to raise funds under the same legal terms. It doesn't say that that Clayton can do something that Diamond can't do. They can do exactly the same thing. The law on its face is entirely equal. Then we bring into that the current or even the former SB 380 formula. The effort there is to direct state resources to those places that have a harder time raising money on their own. And so what you get out of that formula Now, at the moment, as you get Clayton, which I think has now inched its way up from about $387 per pupil per year to somewhere over $500 per pupil per year, you get to the Tarkios and other kind of general, the people in the middle in the state, they're getting close to $5,000 per year, and you get some that are close to $7,000 per year. So the state is actually, and this is probably why it's so hard to fit it into this equal protection context, the state is, in allocating its funds, it is giving as much as 10 times more, or more than 10 times more, to school districts that have lower assessed valuation, that have a harder time raising money, than it is to one that doesn't have problems raising money. It's just very difficult to see how you can characterize that as a restriction. And this court's jurisprudence in the equal protection area has always looked at what is the restriction. What restriction is it the state is imposing in one place and not another? And then the remedy is always to lift that restriction. But there's no restriction here to be lifted. It simply doesn't fit into this context.
Well, isn't that the problem with the freezing the equalizations, is the equivalent sales ratios from 2004? Because you lock in something that, well, wasn't quite so.
Well, I think there are a couple of problems with that argument. One of them is that we aren't very far past 2004, and there is no reason to believe the legislature will or will not next year change that. You know, the legislature changes this formula maybe not every year. I mean, they haven't changed it since last week, and they did, in fact, change it last week. I don't think you can make a case that it is actually frozen forever, because that's not the way this world operates. But certainly there is some ongoing impact.
You will concede, I suppose, at least one piece of this, and that is that when you're talking about real estate evaluations, you're talking about, in our system, appraisals.
Yes.
Which are opinions.
Yes.
And we've built a whole mortgage system in the last several years based upon those opinions.
Yep.
And how's that working out for us? And how's that working out for us?
Well, and actually, let me make a specific comment about the attack that was levied on those assessments. I mean, understand that my biggest problem, other than the standing issue, my biggest problem with the assessment argument is this. What they want you to do is say to the General Assembly, okay, if we find out after the fact that you relied on data you got from an agency that purportedly was operating under state law, and we find out that data was wrong, and you should have known it was wrong, then the whole statute is unconstitutional.
But your opponent says that the legislature had information from a state auditor's report and from an interim committee that showed the information might have been faulty.
Might have been. And I don't know if they were or not. And faulty in that sense is faulty in the sense of it didn't comply with the statute, not faulty in the sense that it was necessarily wrong. Well, part of the problem here is they're arguing they want you to use sales ratios and not appraisals, even though in most counties in the state we have limited sales data. I mean, it may well be that the data that they were working on was more accurate than what they would have if they had complied with what CFES districts say was the law. By the way, it isn't the law anymore. The statute they rely on has been repealed.
And hasn't there been an attempt in the legislature for years to try to make sales valuation mandatory throughout the state as opposed to the metropolitan areas?
I think every year I've been in the Attorney General's office, that has been introduced and has been defeated every time.
Well, how accurate would it really be? I mean, there are places where houses they go centuries without being sold.
It will never be an exact science. Never be an exact science. Let me turn.
Is it your argument, if I'm understanding, that whichever one is better, you only have the figures you have for 2004, and
you have what you have.
That sales analysis.
You have what you have, and if it wasn't good enough, then someone should have sued the state tax commission and said, look, you haven't properly equalized.
But even if that was all they had in 2004, as I understand, the part of the argument is going forward using something you know wasn't good enough. Arguably, as it's written now, it'll be in effect at least until 2013, has problems, even if that was all you had at the time.
Well, I was fascinated with the discussion about what to do about that, with the remedies discussion, because the suggestion was to just take out the language about 2004 and then do what? I mean, at that point, there's nothing in the legislation that says what you were to use. I was afraid for a moment that the CFES districts were going to suggest that you just take out the local effort from the formula entirely. I don't know where it leaves you, because really that's one of the underpinnings of the statute. If you take that out, then maybe the statute entirely disappears, which would probably be in the better interest of the CFES districts, because, well, I don't know. I don't know if it would be in their interest or not. Let me turn for a moment, if I may, to the Hancock Amendment. And not because I think I need to add to what we said in the brief about standing proof or remedy, but because there are two observations that I think are worth making in light of the Hancock Amendment's involvement in this case. The first is this. If there is an adequacy right of the sort that the CE districts claim, which, of course, the language itself, I don't believe, permits you to find, if there is such an adequacy right, then their argument that there is a new mandate that requires state funding under the Hancock Amendment makes no sense, because that existed from, in their own words, all the way from 1875 and was assigned to the school districts far back, back in 1875. It's not a new mandate if it exists. It is a mandate that has been around for many, many years, long before 1980. But my second observation based on Hancock is this one. The cost of what the CE districts ask for, well, varies according to who you ask, but it's somewhere in the range of $1.3 billion. And Judge Wolf, you asked about what is state revenue. We've had those discussions over the years, but at the moment, if you treat as general revenue this year, for the coming year, that's about $7.8 billion. So you've got $1.3 billion. In 1980, the people of the state of Missouri said to the General Assembly, you no longer have authority if you need another $1.3 billion to just enact it. The General Assembly no longer has the authority to give the CE districts what they want. So you have to find $1.3 billion somewhere else. Well, the General Assembly, of course, this year, like every year, has spent days, nights, weeks figuring out what to do with the revenue that it has. It's allocated 25%, and then some, to education, a huge amount compared to what the people in 1945 probably thought they were voting for. But then, beyond that, to get that $1.3 billion, is it really a constitutional question whether the General Assembly takes a dollar and spends it in the classroom rather than in the courtroom or the clinic? You know, many of the needs that underlie the things that Mr. Bartlett argues about in his brief, the CE argues about in his brief, are social services needs. And yet the remedy that they seek would take money out of the state budget, necessarily out of social services, and put them into the schools.
Well, when you look at the generic term state revenue, which is undefined.
Undefined. Undefined in the Constitution.
Right. Why is not state revenue also the money that's raised by a property tax that's authorized by the state?
Well, there are lots of ways to try and define it. We've made no attempt to do that in our briefs because, frankly, there is no appeal here. Well, there is no claim in the case about the 25% figure. There is no appeal here, nothing in the points we relied on about the 25% figure. It's not an issue before this court.
But it is an issue in this sense, and that is that your argument is more or less, if I understand it correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, premised on the fact that a lot of this stuff is kind of, well, some of it's aspirational and some of it's mandatory, but that what is specific in our Constitution, as distinct from almost every other state's Constitution, is the 25%.
And if someone wants to litigate that question again, we're happy to open the door and do it, but that is not the question before the court or ever in this case. I'd like to turn a moment over to Mr. Chin.
May it please the court, briefly, I'd like to address the intervention. The case is, this was a permissive intervention. It set the parameters for the permissive intervention. Judge Callahan specifically addressed this issue in a post-trial motion and said that he looked at the myriad of factors and thought that it was in the best interest that another voice be heard. So the principal case relied on by Mr. Bartlett is the Cooper case, which was a intervention as of right. And I believe that fundamentally disposes of that issue. The other thing, and we started, so I think we should end, with no apologies for the Missouri schools. And while Judge Callahan did not specifically address the facts, what is important is that this lawsuit was initially brought under 380 and then Senate Bill 287 came into effect. It moves from a tax-driven system to a student needs-based system, which the people who testified before the Senate testified puts money in the hands of the students who need it the most. And that's what's happening. The Claytons and the Ledoux of the world are getting less money from the state, and those schools that need it are getting the money. What we're seeing in the last 15 years is that for inflation-adjusted spending, we are rising quicker than that of the United States. We had someone go look at all the focus districts of John Murphy, who looked at the focus district schools, and they showed that those schools are in shape, in good shape, and they can be used to reasonably educate our children. Even Mr. Bartlett's own witness said the facilities are clean, safe, and they can educate children. What we are seeing is that we have strong curriculum-based standards that are ambitious. The state of Missouri students are doing better as a whole than that of the rest of the nation. And effectively, even though it's not before this course, we leave with the comments that were initially made. Missouri schools are in good shape.
Thank you, Council.
The Missouri Constitution does not set any requirement upon a district to provide education. It's the obligation of the state. And if the state opts to have school districts do it, or do parts of it, then it's still the state's obligation. So consequently, the 4,700 or the 15,000 is the state's obligation. And there was a mention that there's more money going up under the formula for the new formula for the districts that are not as well off. I would dispute that. If you look on the internet, DESE, you'll see that Clayton went from in the 14,000s to over 16,000 in the time since the trial. There was a add-on for where the district was, and that has resulted in a three-year phase-in to up the ante, so to say, up the state aid for districts in metropolitan areas, whereas the other districts, to get it's over 7 years. Also say that as far as the general diffusion of knowledge is concerned, the Texas Supreme Court has held that that is a standard, an adequacy standard that is enforceable by the courts of Texas. Diffusion of knowledge has been enforced in Massachusetts, it's been enforced in New Hampshire, it's been enforced in California. All of those states have the general diffusion of knowledge language. So consequently, suggests that that is a Section 1A, Article 9, provides for adequacy and it also provides for equity.
Council, let me ask you a question about that. If we're looking at 3B,
yes.
We have a definite number there, 25%, maybe some quibblings about what you take it up. Court has a bright line rule. If we use 1A as our standard for the diffusion of knowledge and intelligence, would we be required then to address that as a factual issue year by year at the mercy of expert witnesses on both sides saying one thing and another?
I don't think you have to do it year to year. But
periodically,
and I think that's part of the history of it. When things get bad, And as the Joint Committee said in their report back in February of 2004, it has to have a judicial mandate to get things changed, and the formula has to be changed every 10 years at least. And I think those are prophetic things. It's from experience. You had very seasoned people on that committee, from our present President Pro Tem, who was around during Senate Bill 380. You had Harold Caskey, you had John Russell, people who have been around. They didn't agree on any, they agreed that they couldn't infuse any more money. That's part of the report. It all has to be of the same money and just spread around. But those were things that were put together. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Case is submitted.